there. All the literary world is there. I must be well-dressed. That inspires respect, and of itself puts us on an equal footing in the eyes of the society. With this object I asked for some of my salary in advance, and bought at Cherkin's a pair of black gloves and a decent hat. Black gloves seemed to me both more dignified and bon ton than the lemon-colored ones which I had contemplated at first. The color is too gaudy. It looks as though one were trying to be conspicuous, and I did not take the lemon-colored ones. I had got ready long beforehand a good shirt with white bone studs. My overcoat was the only thing that held me back. The coat in itself was a very good one. It kept me warm, but it was wadded, and it had a raccoon collar, which was the height of vulgarity. I had to change the collar at any sacrifice, and to have a beaver one like the officers. For this purpose I began visiting the Gostini Dvor, and after several attempts I pitched upon a piece of cheap German beaver. Though these German beavers soon grow shabby and look wretched, yet at first they look exceedingly well, and I only needed it for the occasion. I asked the price. Even so, it was too expensive. After thinking it over thoroughly, I decided to sell my raccoon collar. The rest of the money, a considerable sum for me, I decided to borrow from Anton Antonich Sviatochkin, my immediate supervisor, an unassuming person, though grave and judicious. He never lent money to anyone, but I had, on entering the service, been specially recommended to him by an important personage who had got me my berth. I was horribly worried. To borrow from Anton Antonich seemed to me monstrous and shameful. I did not sleep for two or three nights. Indeed, I did not sleep well at that time. I was in a fever. I had a vague sinking at my heart, or else a sudden throbbing, throbbing, throbbing. Anton Antonich was surprised at first. Then he frowned. Then he reflected, and did, after all, lend me the money, receiving from me a written authorization to take from my salary a fortnight later the sum that he had lent me. In this way everything was at last ready. The handsome beaver replaced the mean-looking raccoon, and I began by degrees to get to work. It would never have done to act off-hand, at random. The plan had to be carried out skilfully, by degrees. But I must confess that after many efforts I began to despair. We simply could not run into each other. I made every preparation. I was quite determined. It seemed as though we should run into one another directly, and before I knew what I was doing, I had stepped aside for him again, and he had passed without noticing me. I even prayed, as I approached him, that God would grant me determination. One time I had made up my mind thoroughly, but it ended in my stumbling and falling at his feet, because at the very last instant, when I was 6 inches from him, my courage failed me. He very calmly stepped over me, while I flew on one side like a ball. That night I was ill again, feverish and delirious. And suddenly it ended most happily. The night before I had made up my mind not to carry out my fatal plan, and to abandon it all, and with that object I went to the Nevsky for the last time, just to see how I would abandon it all. Suddenly, 3 paces from my enemy, I unexpectedly made up my mind. I closed my eyes, and we ran full tilt, shoulder to shoulder, against one another. I did not budge an inch, and passed him on a perfectly equal footing. He did not even look round and pretended not to notice it, but he was only pretending. I am convinced of that. I am convinced of that to this day. Of course, I got the worst of it. He was stronger, but that was not the point. The point was that I had attained my object. I had kept up my dignity. I had not yielded a step, and had put myself publicly on an equal social footing with him. I returned home feeling that I was fully avenged for everything. I was delighted, and I was triumphant, and sang Italian arias. Of course, I will not describe to you what happened to me 3 days later. If you have read my first chapter, you can guess for yourself. The officer was afterwards transferred. I have not seen him now for 14 years. What is the dear fellow doing now? Whom is he walking over? 2. But the period of my dissipation would end, and I always felt very sick afterwards. It was followed by remorse. I tried to drive it away. I felt too sick. By degrees, however, I grew used to that, too. I grew used to everything, or rather, I voluntarily resigned myself to enduring it. But I had a means of escape that reconciled everything. That was to find refuge in the sublime and the beautiful, in dreams, of course. I was a terrible dreamer. I would dream for 3 months on end, tucked away in my corner. And you may believe me that at those moments I had no resemblance to the gentleman who, in the perturbation of his chicken heart, put a collar of German beaver on his greatcoat. I suddenly became a hero. I would not have admitted my 6-foot lieutenant even if he had called on me. I could not even picture him before me then. What were my dreams and how I could satisfy myself with them, it is hard to say now, but at the time I was satisfied with them, though, indeed, even now I am to some extent satisfied with them. Dreams were particularly sweet and vivid after a spell of dissipation. They came with remorse and with tears, with curses and transports. There were moments of such positive intoxication, of such happiness, that there was not the faintest trace of irony within me, on my honour. I had faith, hope, love. I believed blindly at such times that by some miracle, by some external circumstance, all this would suddenly open out, expand, that suddenly a vista of suitable activity, beneficent, good, and above all, ready-made. What sort of activity, I had no idea, but the great thing was that it should all be ready for me, would rise up before me, and I should come out into the light of day, almost riding a white horse and crowned with laurel. Anything but the foremost place I could not conceive for myself, and for that very reason I quite contentedly occupied the lowest in reality. Either to be a hero or to grovel in the mud. There was nothing between. That was my ruin. For when I was in the mud, I comforted myself with the thought that at other times I was a hero, and the hero was a cloak for the mud. For an ordinary man it was shameful to defile himself, but a hero was too lofty to be utterly defiled, and so he might defile himself. It is worth noting that these attacks of the sublime and beautiful visited me even during the period of dissipation and just at the times when I was touching the bottom. They came in separate spurts, as though reminding me of themselves, but did not banish the dissipation by their appearance. On the contrary, they seemed to add a zest to it by contrast, and were only sufficiently present to serve as an appetizing sauce. That sauce was made up of contradictions and sufferings, of agonizing inward analysis, and all these pangs and pinpricks give a certain piquancy, even a significance to my dissipation. In fact, completely answered the purpose of an appetizing sauce. There was a certain depth of meaning in it, and I could hardly have resigned myself to the simple, vulgar, direct debauchery of a clerk, and have endured all the filthiness of it. What could have allured me about it then, and have drawn me at night into the street? No, I had a lofty way of getting out of it all. And what loving-kindness, O Lord, what loving-kindness I felt at times in those dreams of mine, in those flights into the sublime and the beautiful, though it was fantastic love, though it was never applied to anything human in reality, yet there was so much of this love that one did not feel afterwards even the impulse to apply it in reality. That would have been superfluous. Everything, however, passed satisfactorily by a lazy and fascinating transition into the sphere of art, that is, into the beautiful forms of life, lying ready, largely stolen from the poets and novelists, and adapted to all sorts of needs and uses. I, for instance, was triumphant over everyone. Everyone, of course, was in dust and ashes, and was forced spontaneously to recognize my superiority, and I forgave them all. I was a poet and a grand gentleman. I fell in love. I came in for countless millions and immediately devoted them to humanity, and at the same time I confessed before all the people my shameful deeds, which, of course, were not merely shameful, but had in them much that was sublime and beautiful, something in the Manfred style. Every one would kiss me and weep. What idiots they would be if they did not, while I should go barefoot and hungry, preaching new ideas and fighting a victorious Austerlitz against the obscurantists. Then the band would play a march, an amnesty would be declared, the Pope would agree to retire from Rome to Brazil. Then there would be a ball for the whole of Italy at the Villa Borghese, on the shores of Lake Como, Lake Como being for that purpose transferred to the neighborhood of Rome. Then would come a scene in the bushes, and so on, as though you did not know all about it. You will say that it is vulgar and contemptible to drag all this into public after all the tears and transports which I have myself confessed. But why is it contemptible? Can you imagine that I am ashamed of it at all, and that it was stupider than anything in your life, gentlemen? And I can assure you that some of these fancies were by no means badly composed. It did not all happen on the shores of Lake Como, and yet you are right, it really is vulgar and contemptible, and most contemptible of all is that now I am attempting to justify myself to you. And even more contemptible than that is my making this remark now. But that's enough, or there will be no end to it. Each step will be more contemptible than the last. I could never stand more than 3 months of dreaming at a time without feeling an irresistible desire to plunge into society. To plunge into society meant to visit my superior at the office, Anton Antonich Sviatochkin. He was the only permanent acquaintance I have had in my life, and I wonder at the fact myself now. But I only went to see him when that phase came over me, and when my dreams had reached such a point of bliss that it became essential at once to embrace my fellows and all mankind. And for that purpose I needed at least one human being actually existing. I had to call on Anton Antonich, however, on Tuesday, his at-home day, so I had always to time my passionate desire to embrace humanity so that it might fall on a Tuesday. This Anton Antonich lived on the fourth story in a house in Five Corners, in four low-pitched rooms, one smaller than the other, of a particularly frugal and sallow appearance. He had two daughters and their aunt, who used to pour out the tea. Of the daughters, one was 13 and another 14. They both had snub noses, and I was awfully shy of them because they were always whispering and giggling together. The master of the house usually sat in his study on a leather couch in front of the table with some gray-headed gentleman, usually a colleague from our office or some other department. I never saw more than two or three visitors there, always the same. They talked about the excise duty, about business in the Senate, about salaries, about promotions, about His Excellency and the best means of pleasing him, and so on. I had the patience to sit like a fool beside these people for 4 hours at a stretch, listening to them without knowing what to say to them or venturing to say a word. I became stupefied. Several times I felt myself perspiring. I was overcome by a sort of paralysis. But this was pleasant and good for me. On returning home, I deferred for a time my desire to embrace all mankind. I had, however, one other acquaintance of a sort, Simonov, who was an old schoolfellow. I had a number of schoolfellows, indeed, in Petersburg, but I did not associate with them, and had even given up nodding to them in the street. I believe I had transferred into the department I was in simply to avoid their company, and to cut off all connection with my hateful childhood. Curses on that school, and all those terrible years of penal servitude! In short, I parted from my schoolfellows as soon as I got out into the world. There were two or three left to whom I nodded in the street. One of them was Simonov, who had in no way been distinguished at school, was of a quiet and equable disposition, but I discovered in him a certain independence of character, and even honesty. I don't even suppose that he was particularly stupid. I had at one time spent some rather soulful moments with him, but these had not lasted long, and had somehow been suddenly clouded over. He was evidently uncomfortable at these reminiscences, and was, I fancy, always afraid that I might take up the same tone again. I suspected that he had an aversion for me, but still I went on going to see him, not being quite certain of it. And so, on occasion, unable to endure my solitude, and knowing that, as it was Thursday, Anton Antonich's door would be closed, I thought of Simonov. Climbing up to his fourth story, I was thinking that the man disliked me, and that it was a mistake to go and see him. But, as it always happened that such reflections impelled me, as though purposely to put myself into a false position, I went in. It was almost a year since I had last seen Simonov. End of Part 1. Notes from the Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Apropos of the Wet Snow, Part 2. 3. I found two of my old schoolfellows with him. They seemed to be discussing an important matter. All of them took scarcely any notice of my entrance, which was strange, for I had not met them for years. Evidently they looked upon me as something on the level of a common fly. I had not been treated like that even at school, though they all hated me. I knew, of course, that they must despise me now for my lack of success in the service, and for my having let myself sink so low, going about badly dressed and so on, which seemed to them a sign of my incapacity and insignificance. But I had not expected such contempt. Simonov was positively surprised at my turning up. Even in old days he had always seemed surprised at my coming. All this disconcerted me. I sat down, feeling rather miserable, and began listening to what they were saying. They were engaged in warm and earnest conversation about a farewell dinner which they wanted to arrange for the next day to a comrade of theirs called Tsverkov, an officer in the army who was going away to a distant province. This Tsverkov had been all the time at school with me, too. I had begun to hate him, particularly in the upper forms. In the lower forms he had simply been a pretty, playful boy whom everybody liked. I had hated him, however, even in the lower forms, just because he was a pretty and playful boy. He was always bad at his lessons, and got worse and worse as he went on. However, he left with a good certificate, as he had powerful interests. During his last year at school he came in for an estate of 200 serfs, and as almost all of us were poor, he took up a swaggering tone among us. He was vulgar in the extreme, but at the same time he was a good-natured fellow, even in his swaggering. In spite of superficial, fantastic, and sham notions of honor and dignity, All but very few of us positively grovelled before Sverkov, and the more so, the more he swaggered. And it was not from any interested motive that they grovelled, but simply because he had been favoured by the gifts of nature. Moreover, it was, as it were, an accepted idea among us that Sverkov was a specialist in regard to tact and the social graces. This last fact particularly infuriated me. I hated the abrupt, self-confident tone of his voice, his admiration of his own witticisms, which were often frightfully stupid, though he was bold in his language. I hated his handsome but stupid face, for which I would, however, have gladly exchanged my intelligent one, and the free and easy military manners in fashion in the 40s. I hated the way in which he used to talk of his future conquests of women. He did not venture to begin his attack upon women until he had the epaulets of an officer and was looking forward to them with impatience, and boasted of the duels he would constantly be fighting. I remember how I, invariably so taciturn, suddenly fastened upon Sverkov, when one day, talking at a leisure moment with his schoolfellows of his future relations with the fair sex, and growing as sportive as a puppy in the sun, he all at once declared that he would not leave a single village girl on his estate unnoticed, that that was his droit de seigneur, and that if the peasants dared to protest, he would have them all flogged and double the tax on them, the bearded rascals. Our servile rabble applauded, but I attacked him, not from compassion for the girls and their fathers, but simply because they were applauding such an insect. I got the better of him on that occasion, but though Sverkov was stupid, he was lively and impudent, and so laughed it off, and in such a way that my victory was not really complete. The laugh was on his side. He got the better of me on several occasions afterwards, but without malice, jestingly, casually. I remained angrily and contemptuously silent and would not answer him. When he left school, he made advances to me. I did not rebuff them, for I was flattered, but we soon parted, and quite naturally. Afterwards, I heard of his barrack-room success as a lieutenant, and of the fast life he was leading. Then there came other rumours of his successes in the service. By then he had taken to cutting me in the street, and I suspected that he was afraid of compromising himself by greeting a personage as insignificant as me. I saw him once in the theatre, in the third tier of boxes. By then he was wearing shoulder straps. He was twisting and twirling about, ingratiating himself with the daughters of an ancient general. In 3 years he had gone off considerably, though he was still rather handsome and adroit. One could see that by the time he was 30 he would be corpulent. So it was to this Sverkov that my schoolfellows were going to give a dinner on his departure. They had kept up with him for those 3 years, though privately they did not consider themselves on an equal footing with him. I am convinced of that. Of Simonov's two visitors, one was Ferfitchkin, a Russianized German, a little fellow with the face of a monkey, a blockhead who was always deriding everyone, a very bitter enemy of mine from our days in the lower forms, a vulgar, impudent, swaggering fellow who affected a most sensitive feeling of personal honour, though, of course, he was a wretched little coward at heart. He was one of those worshippers of Sverkov who made up to the latter from interested motives and often borrowed money from him. Simonov's other visitor, Trodolyubov, was a person in no way remarkable. A tall young fellow in the army with a cold face, fairly honest, though he worshipped success of every sort, and was only capable of thinking of promotion. He was some sort of distant relation of Sverkov's, and this, foolish as it seems, gave him a certain importance among us. He always thought me of no consequence whatever. His behaviour to me, though not quite courteous, was tolerable. "Well, with 7 rubles each," said Trodolyubov, 21 rubles between the three of us. We ought to be able to get a good dinner. Sverkov, of course, won't pay."
"Of course not, since we are inviting him," Simonov decided.
"Can you imagine," Ferfitchkin interrupted hotly and conceitedly, like some insolent flunky boasting of his master the general's decorations, "can you imagine that Sverkov will let us pay alone? He will accept from delicacy, but he will order half a dozen bottles of champagne."
"Do we want half a dozen for the four of us?" observed Trudolyubov, taking notice only of the half dozen.
"So the three of us, with Sverkov for the fourth, 21 rubles, at the Hotel de Paris at 5 o'clock tomorrow," Simonov, who had been asked to make the arrangements, concluded finally.
"Well, 21 rubles, I asked in some agitation, with a show of being offended. "If you count me, it will not be 21, but 28 rubles.
It seemed to me that to invite myself so suddenly and unexpectedly would be positively graceful, and that they would all be conquered at once and would look at me with respect.
Do you want to join, too?" Simonov observed, with no appearance of pleasure, seeming to avoid looking at me. He knew me through and through. It infuriated me that he knew me so thoroughly.
"Why not? I'm an old schoolfellow of his, too, I believe, and I must own I feel hurt that you have left me out," I said, boiling over again.
"And where were we to find you?" Ferfitchkin put in roughly.
"You never were on good terms with Sverkov," Trudolyubov added, frowning. But I had already clutched at the idea and would not give it up.
"It seems to me that no one has a right to form an opinion upon that," I retorted in a shaking voice, as though something tremulous had happened.
"Perhaps that is just my reason for wishing it now, that I have not always been on good terms with him."
"Oh, there's no making you out with these refinements," Trudolyubov jeered.
"We'll put your name down," Simonov decided, addressing me. "Tomorrow, at 5 o'clock, at the Hotel de Paris."
"What about the money?"
Ferfitchkin began in an undertone, indicating me to Simonov, but he broke off, for even Simonov was embarrassed.
"That will do," said Trudolyubov, getting up. "If he wants to come so much, let him."
"But it's a private thing, between us friends," Ferfitchkin said crossly, as he too picked up his hat. "It's not an official gathering. We do not want at all, perhaps."
They went away. Ferfitchkin did not greet me in any way as he went out. Trudolyubov barely nodded. Simonov, with whom I was left tête-à-tête, was in a state of vexation and perplexity, and looked at me queerly. He did not sit down and did not ask me to.
Yes, tomorrow, then. Will you pay your subscription now? I just ask so as to know," he muttered in embarrassment.
I flushed crimson. As I did so, I remembered that I had owed Simonov 15 rubles for ages, which I had indeed never forgotten, though I had not paid it.
"You will understand, Simonov, that I could have no idea when I came here. I am very much vexed that I have forgotten.
All right, that doesn't matter. You can pay tomorrow after the dinner. I simply wanted to know. Please don't."
He broke off and began pacing the room still more vexed. As he walked, he began to stamp with his heels.
"Am I keeping you?" I asked, after 2 minutes of silence.
"Oh," he said, starting. "That is, to be truthful, yes. I have to go and see someone, not far from here," he added, in an apologetic voice, somewhat abashed.
"My goodness, why didn't you say so?" I cried, seizing my cap, with an astonishingly free and easy air, which was the last thing I should have expected of myself.
"It's close by, not 2 paces away," Simonov repeated, accompanying me to the front door with a fussy air which did not suit him at all. "So, 5 o'clock, punctually, tomorrow,"
he called down the stairs after me. He was very glad to get rid of me. I was in a fury.
"What possessed me? What possessed me to force myself upon them?" I wondered, grinding my teeth as I strode along the street. "For a scoundrel, a pig like that Zverkov. Of course I had better not go. Of course I must just snap my fingers at them. I am not bound in any way. I'll send Simonov a note by tomorrow's post. But what made me furious was that I knew for certain that I should go, that I should make a point of going. And the more tactless, the more unseemly my going would be, the more certainly I would go. And there was a positive obstacle to my going. I had no money. All I had was 9 rubles. I had to give 7 of that to my servant, Apollon, for his monthly wages. That was all I paid him. He had to keep himself. Not to pay him was impossible, considering his character. But I will talk about that fellow, about that plague of mine, another time. However, I knew I should go and should not pay him his wages. That night I had the most hideous dreams. No wonder. All the evening I had been oppressed by memories of my miserable days at school, and I could not shake them off. I was sent to the school by distant relations, upon whom I was dependent, and of whom I have heard nothing since. They sent me there a forlorn, silent boy, already crushed by their reproaches, already troubled by doubt, and looking with savage distrust at everyone. My schoolfellows met me with spiteful and merciless jibes because I was not like any of them. But I could not endure their taunts. I could not give in to them with the ignoble readiness with which they gave in to one another. I hated them from the first, and shut myself away from everyone in timid, wounded, and disproportionate pride. Their coarseness revolted me. They laughed cynically at my face, at my clumsy figure, and yet what stupid faces they had themselves! In our school the boys' faces seemed in a special way to degenerate, grow stupider. How many fine-looking boys came to us! In a few years they became repulsive. Even at 16 I wondered at them morosely. Even then I was struck by the pettiness of their thoughts, the stupidity of their pursuits, their games, their conversations. They had no understanding of such essential things. They took no interest in such striking, impressive subjects that I could not help considering them inferior to myself. It was not wounded vanity that drove me to it, and for God's sake do not thrust upon me your hackneyed remarks, repeated to nausea, that I was only a dreamer, while they even then had an understanding of life. They understood nothing. They had no idea of real life, and I swear that that was what made me most indignant with them. On the contrary, the most obvious, striking reality they accepted with fantastic stupidity, and even at that time were accustomed to respect success. Everything that was just, but oppressed and looked down upon, they laughed at heartlessly and shamefully. They took rank for intelligence. Even at 16 they were already talking about a snug berth. Of course, a great deal of it was due to their stupidity, to the bad examples with which they had always been surrounded in their childhood and boyhood. They were monstrously depraved. Of course, a great deal of that, too, was superficial and an assumption of cynicism. Of course, there were glimpses of youth and freshness even in their depravity. But even that freshness was not attractive, and showed itself in a certain rakishness. I hated them horribly, though perhaps I was worse than any of them. They repaid me in the same way, and did not conceal their aversion for me. But by then I did not desire their affection. On the contrary, I continually longed for their humiliation.
To escape from their derision, I purposely began to make all the progress I could with my studies, and forced my way to the very top. This impressed them. Moreover, they all began by degrees to grasp that I had already read books none of them could read, and understood things, not forming part of our school curriculum, of which they had not even heard. They took a savage and sarcastic view of it, but were morally impressed, especially as the teachers began to notice me on those grounds. The mockery ceased, but the hostility remained, and cold and strained relations became permanent between us. In the end, I could not put up with it. With years a craving for society, for friends, developed in me. I attempted to get on friendly terms with some of my schoolfellows, but somehow or other my intimacy with them was always strained and soon ended of itself. Once, indeed, I did have a friend, but I was already a tyrant at heart. I wanted to exercise unbounded sway over him. I tried to instill in him a contempt for his surroundings. I required of him a disdainful and complete break with those surroundings. I frightened him with my passionate affection. I reduced him to tears, to hysterics. He was a simple and devoted soul. But when he devoted himself to me entirely, I began to hate him immediately and repulsed him, as though all I needed him for was to win a victory over him, to subjugate him, and nothing else. But I could not subjugate all of them. My friend was not at all like them either. He was, in fact, a rare exception. The first thing I did on leaving school was to give up the special job for which I had been destined, so as to break all ties, to curse my past, and shake the dust from off my feet. And goodness knows why, after all that, I should go trudging off to Semenoff's. Early next morning I roused myself and jumped out of bed with excitement, as though it were all about to happen at once. But I believed that some radical change in my life was coming, and would inevitably come that day. Owing to its rarity, perhaps, any external event, however trivial, always made me feel as though some radical change in my life were at hand. I went to the office, however, as usual, but sneaked away home 2 hours earlier to get ready. The great thing, I thought, is not to be the first to arrive, or they will think I am overjoyed at coming. But there are thousands of such great points to consider, and they all agitated and overwhelmed me. I polished my boots a second time with my own hands. Nothing in the world would have induced Apollon to clean them twice a day, as he considered that it was more than his duties required of him. I stole the brushes to clean them from the passage, being careful he should not detect it, for fear of his contempt. Then I minutely examined my clothes, and thought that everything looked old, worn, and threadbare. I had let myself get too slovenly. My uniform, perhaps, was tidy, but I could not go out to dinner in my uniform. The worst of it was that on the knee of my trousers was a big yellow stain. I had a foreboding that that stain would deprive me of 9/10 of my personal dignity. I knew, too, that it was very poor to think so. But this is no time for thinking. Now I am in for the real thing, I thought, and my heart sank. I knew, too, perfectly well even then, that I was monstrously exaggerating the facts. But how could I help it? I could not control myself, and was already shaking with fever. With despair I pictured to myself how coldly and disdainfully that scoundrel Sverkov would meet me, with what dull-witted, invincible contempt the blockhead Trudolyubov would look at me, with what impudent rudeness the insect Ferfitchkin would snigger at me in order to curry favor with Sverkov. How completely Semenoff would take it all in, and how he would despise me for the abjectness of my vanity and lack of spirit, and worst of all,
how paltry, unliterary, commonplace it would all be. Of course, the best thing would be not to go at all, but that was most impossible of all. If I feel impelled to do anything, I seem to be pitchforked into it. I should have jeered at myself ever afterwards. So you funked it, you funked it, you funked the real thing. On the contrary, I passionately longed to show all that rabble that I was by no means such a spiritless creature as I seemed to myself. What is more, even in the acutest paroxysm of this cowardly fever, I dreamed of getting the upper hand, of dominating them, carrying them away, making them like me, if only for my elevation of thought and unmistakable wit. They would abandon Sverkov. He would sit on one side, silent and ashamed, while I should crush him. Then, perhaps, we would be reconciled and drink to our everlasting friendship. But what was most bitter and humiliating for me was that I knew, even then, knew fully and for certain, that I needed nothing of all this, really, that I did not really want to crush, to subdue, to attract them, that I did not care a straw, really, for the result, even if I did achieve it. Oh, how I prayed for the day to pass quickly! In unutterable anguish I went to the window, opened the movable pane, and looked out into the troubled darkness of the thickly falling wet snow. At last my wretched little clock hissed out five. I seized my hat, and trying not to look at Apollon, who had been all day expecting his month's wages, but in his foolishness was unwilling to be the first to speak about it, I slipped between him and the door, and, jumping into a high-class sledge, on which I spent my last half-rouble, I drove up in grand style to the Hotel de Paris. 4. I had been certain the day before that I should be the first to arrive, but it was not a question of being the first to arrive. Not only were they not there, but I had difficulty in finding our room. The table was not laid, even. What did it mean? After a good many questions, I elicited from the waiters that the dinner had been ordered not for 5, but for 6 o'clock. This was confirmed at the buffet, too. I felt really ashamed to go on questioning them. It was only 5:25. If they had changed the dinner hour, they ought at least to have let me know. That is what the post is for, and not to have put me in an absurd position in my own eyes, and even before the waiters. I sat down. The servant began laying the table. I felt even more humiliated when he was present. Towards 6 o'clock they brought in candles, though there were lamps burning in the room. It had not occurred to the waiter, however, to bring them in at once when I arrived. In the next room, 2 gloomy, angry-looking persons were eating their dinners in silence at 2 different tables. There was a great deal of noise, even shouting, in a room further away. One could hear the laughter of a crowd of people and nasty little shrieks in French. There were ladies at the dinner. It was sickening, in fact. I rarely passed more unpleasant moments, so much so that when they did arrive, all together, punctually, at 6, I was overjoyed to see them, as though they were my deliverers, and even forgot that it was incumbent upon me to show resentment. Sverkov walked in at the head of them. Evidently he was the leading spirit. He and all of them were laughing, but seeing me, Sverkov drew himself up a little, walked up to me deliberately, with a slight, rather jaunty bend from the waist. He shook hands with me in a friendly, but not over-friendly fashion, with a sort of circumspect courtesy like that of a general, as though in giving me his hand he were warding off something. I had imagined, on the contrary, that on coming in he would at once break into his habitual thin, shrill laugh, and fall to making his insipid jokes and witticisms.
I had been preparing for them ever since the previous day, but I had not expected such condescension, such high official courtesy. So then, he felt himself ineffably superior to me in every respect. If he only meant to insult me by that high official tone, it would not matter, I thought. I could pay him back for it one way or another. But what if, in reality, without the least desire to be offensive, that sheep's head had a notion in earnest that he was superior to me and could only look at me in a patronizing way? The very supposition made me gasp. "I was surprised to hear of your desire to join us," he began, lisping and drawling, which was something new. "You and I seem to have seen nothing of one another. You fight shy of us. You shouldn't. We are not such terrible people as you think. Well, anyway, I am glad to renew our acquaintance." And he turned carelessly to put down his hat on the window. "Have you been waiting long?" Trudolyubov inquired. "I arrived at 5 o'clock, as you told me yesterday," I answered aloud, with an irritability that threatened an explosion. "Didn't you let him know that we had changed the hour?" said Trudolyubov to Simonov. "No, I didn't. I forgot," the latter replied, with no sign of regret, and without even apologizing to me, he went off to order the hors d'oeuvres. "So you've been here a whole hour? Oh, poor fellow!" Sverkov cried ironically, for to his notions that was bound to be extremely funny. That rascal Ferfitchkin followed with his nasty little snigger like a puppy yapping. My position struck him, too, as exquisitely ludicrous and embarrassing. "It isn't funny at all," I cried to Ferfitchkin, more and more irritated. "It wasn't my fault, but other people's. They neglected to let me know. It was simply absurd." "It's not only absurd, but something else as well," muttered Trudolyubov, naively taking my part. "You are not hard enough upon it. It was simply rudeness, unintentional, of course. And how could Simonov—" "If a trick like that had been played on me," observed Ferfitchkin, "I should—but you should have ordered something for yourself," Sverkov interrupted, "or simply asked for dinner without waiting for us. You will allow that I might have done that without your permission?" I rapped out. "If I waited, it was—" "Let us sit down, gentlemen," cried Simonov, coming in. "Everything is ready. I can answer for the champagne. It is capitally frozen. You see, I did not know your address. Where was I to look for you?" He suddenly turned to me, but again he seemed to avoid looking at me. Evidently he had something against me. It must have been what happened yesterday. All sat down. I did the same. It was a round table. Trudolyubov was on my left, Simonov on my right, Sverkov was sitting opposite, Ferfitchkin next to him, between him and Trudolyubov. "Tell me, are you in a government office?" Sverkov went on, attending to me. Seeing that I was embarrassed, he seriously thought that he ought to be friendly to me, and, so to speak, cheer me up. "Does he want me to throw a bottle at his head?" I thought, in a fury. In my novel surroundings I was unnaturally ready to be irritated. "In the N office," I answered jerkily, with my eyes on my plate. "And have you a good berth? I say, what made you leave your original job?" "What made me was that I wanted to leave my original job," I drawled more than he, hardly able to control myself. Ferfitchkin went off into a guffaw. Simonov looked at me ironically. Trudolyubov left off eating and began looking at me with curiosity. Sverkov winced, but he tried not to notice it. "And the remuneration?" "What remuneration?" "I mean your salary. Why are you cross-examining me?" However, I told him at once what my salary was. I turned horribly red. "It is not very handsome," Sverkov observed majestically.
"Yes, you can't afford to dine at cafes on that," Ferfitchkin added insolently.
"To my thinking, it's very poor," Trudolyubov observed gravely.
"And how thin you have grown! How you have changed!" added Sverkov, with a shade of venom in his voice, scanning me and my attire with a sort of insolent compassion.
"Ah, spare his blushes!" cried Ferfitchkin, sniggering.
"My dear sir, allow me to tell you I am not blushing," I broke out at last. "Do you hear? I am dining here at this café at my own expense, not at other people's. Note that, Mr. Ferfitchkin."
"What? Isn't everyone here dining at his own expense? You would seem to be—"
Ferfitchkin flew out at me, turning as red as a lobster and looking me in the face with fury.
"That," I answered, feeling I had gone too far, "and I imagine it would be better to talk of something more intelligent."
"You intend to show off your intelligence, I suppose? Don't disturb yourself. That would be quite out of place here.
Why are you clacking away like that, my good sir, huh? Have you gone out of your wits in your office?"
"Enough, gentlemen, enough," Sverkov cried authoritatively.
"How stupid it is," muttered Simonov.
"It really is stupid. We have met here, a company of friends, for a farewell dinner to a comrade, and you carry on an altercation," said Trudolyubov, rudely addressing himself to me alone. "You invited yourself to join us, so don't disturb the general harmony."
"Enough, enough," cried Sverkov. "Give over, gentlemen. It's out of place. Better let me tell you how I nearly got married the day before yesterday."
And then followed a burlesque narrative of how this gentleman had almost been married 2 days before. There was not a word about the marriage, however, but the story was adorned with generals, colonels, and kammerjunkers, while Sverkov almost took the lead among them. It was greeted with approving laughter. Ferfitchkin positively squealed. No one paid any attention to me, and I sat crushed and humiliated. "Good heavens, these are not the people for me," I thought, "and what a fool I have made of myself before them. I let Ferfitchkin go too far, though. The brutes imagine they are doing me an honor and letting me sit down with them. They don't understand that it's an honor to them and not to me. I've grown thinner. My clothes, oh, damn my trousers. Sverkov noticed the yellow stain on the knee as soon as he came in. But what's the use? I must get up at once, this very minute, take my hat and simply go, without a word. With contempt, and tomorrow I can send a challenge. The scoundrels, as though I cared about the 7 rubles. They may think. Damn it, I don't care about the 7 rubles. I'll go this minute." Of course, I remained. I drank sherry and Lafitte's by the glassful in my discomfiture. Being unaccustomed to it, I was quickly affected. My annoyance increased as the wine went to my head. I longed all at once to insult them all in a most flagrant manner and then go away, to seize the moment and show what I could do so that they would say, "He's clever, though he is absurd, and, in fact, damn them all." I scanned them all insolently with my drowsy eyes, but they seemed to have forgotten me altogether. They were noisy, vociferous, cheerful. Sverkov was talking all the time. I began listening. Sverkov was talking of some exuberant lady whom he had at last led on to declaring her love. Of course he was lying like a horse, and how he had been helped in this affair by an intimate friend of his, a Prince Kolya, an officer in the Hussars, who had 3,000 serfs. "And yet this Kolya, who has 3,000 serfs, has not put in an appearance here tonight to see you off," I cut in suddenly. For 1 minute everyone was silent.
"You are drunk already," Trudolyubov deigned to notice me at last, glancing contemptuously in my direction. Zverkov, without a word, examined me as though I were an insect. I dropped my eyes. Simonov made haste to fill up the glasses with champagne. Trudolyubov raised his glass, as did everyone else but me.
"Your health and good luck on the journey," he cried to Zverkov. "To old times, to our future. Hurrah!"
They all tossed off their glasses and crowded round Zverkov to kiss him. I did not move, my full glass still untouched before me.
"Why, aren't you going to drink it?"
roared Trudolyubov, losing patience and turning menacingly to me.
"I want to make a speech separately on my own account, and then I'll drink it, Mr. Trudolyubov."
"Spiteful brute," muttered Simonov. I drew myself up in my chair and feverishly seized my glass, prepared for something extraordinary, though I did not know myself precisely what I was going to say.
"Silence!" cried Ferfitchkin. "Now for a display of wit!"
Zverkov waited very gravely, knowing what was coming.
"Mr. Lieutenant Zverkov," I began, "let me tell you that I hate phrases, phrase-mongers, and men in corsets. That's the first point, and there is a second one to follow it."
There was a general stir.
"The second point is, I hate ribaldry and ribald talkers, especially ribald talkers. The third point, I love justice, truth, and honesty."
I went on almost mechanically, for I was beginning to shiver with horror myself, and had no idea how I came to be talking like this.
"I love thought, Monsieur Zverkov. I love a true comradeship on an equal footing, and not... I love... But, however, why not? I will drink your health, too, Mr. Zverkov. Seduce the Circassian girls, shoot the enemies of the fatherland, and to your health, Monsieur Zverkov."
Zverkov got up from his seat, bowed to me, and said,
"I am very much obliged to you."
He was frightfully offended and turned pale.
"Damn the fellow,"
roared Trudolyubov, bringing his fist down on the table.
"Well, he wants a punch in the face for that," squealed Ferfitchkin. "We ought to turn him out," muttered Simonov.
"Not a word, gentlemen, not a movement," cried Zverkov solemnly, checking the general indignation.
"I thank you all, but I can show him for myself how much value I attach to his words. Mr. Ferfitchkin, you will give me satisfaction tomorrow for your words just now," I said aloud, turning with dignity to Ferfitchkin. "A duel, you mean?"
"Certainly," he answered. But probably I was so ridiculous as I challenged him, and he was so out of keeping with my appearance, that everyone, including Ferfitchkin, was prostrate with laughter.
"Yes, let him alone, of course. He is quite drunk," Trudolyubov said with disgust. "I shall never forgive myself for letting him join in," Simonov muttered again. "Now is the time to throw a bottle at their heads," I thought to myself. I picked up the bottle and filled my glass. "No, I'd better sit on to the end," I went on thinking. "You would be pleased, my friends, if I went away. Nothing will induce me to go. I'll go on sitting here and drinking to the end, on purpose, as a sign that I don't think you of the slightest consequence. I will go on sitting and drinking because this is a public house and I paid my entrance money. I'll sit here and drink, for I look upon you as so many pawns, as inanimate pawns. I'll sit here and drink, and sing if I want to. Yes, sing, for I have the right to sing." But I did not sing. I simply tried not to look at any of them.
I assumed most unconcerned attitudes, and waited with impatience for them to speak first. But, alas, they did not address me, and oh, how I wished at that moment to be reconciled to them. It struck 8, at last 9. They moved from the table to the sofa. Sverkov stretched himself on a lounge and put one foot on a round table. Wine was brought there. He did, as a fact,